It's The Wonky Show. We talk Skidmore Talking Research, what politicians think of universities, there's a new book on social mobility, and the only university rankings that matter. It's all coming up.
There's a bit of consensus around needing to respond to changing skills needs. So half of MPs think new courses in these areas should be a priority. But what those courses look like varies. So Labour MPs tend to prioritise representation and mental health provision, whereas Conservatives are more like...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education, policy, people and politics. I'm Rachel Firth, this week coming to you live from our event, Rules of Engagement, and here to table an early day motion on higher education policy. As usual, we have three fabulous guests. In Cheltenham, we have Sarah Barmiller, Head of Insight for UCAS Media. Sarah, give us your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, my highlight of the week is actually a new data product that my team have been developing, which will help providers understand where they land at A-level results day. So it provides them a really good insight as to where their gaps are going to be in clearing, which is available through UCAS Media right now.
Little plug there. I like that at the start of the show. And in Ormskirk, we have Vice President Academic at Edgehill University Students Union, Luke Meyer. Luke, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi. So, my highlight is much less worthy than Sarah's, but I'm on crutches this week. But one of our student volunteers gave me a bedazzler so I can make my crutches fabulous. So I'm very excited by that.
What is a bedazzler?
Well, it's like it just adds little gems to things. So like I've got like notebooks covered in gems. Everything's very sparkly.
And also coming to us live from our event, Rules of Engagement, we have Wonky's Associate Editor, David Kernahan, sometimes known as DK. DK, give us your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it has to be Rules of Engagement. This is going to be a great event. I'd like you all to know out there in listener land that I am missing hearing Matt Chorley so I can speak to you here. So I'd like a little bit of respect for that, please. In the wider world, I really enjoyed Roger Scruton's intervention on universities this week. Apparently, they're so full of left-wing thought that we should just close them all down.
Right. In his second of four speeches on the topic, Chris Skidmore, Minister for University Science and Research, launched the government's International Research and Innovation Strategy, which is a key part of achieving the government's target of 2.4% of GDP on research and development by 2027. Also this week, Chris Skidmore has called on the sector to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which the UK voted against adopting the definition just a few months ago. So DK, can you take us through this in Malay, please?
So it's been a busy week for Chris Skidmore. As you say, at the start of the week, we saw the launch of the international strategy. This is essentially a prospectus for UK higher education's research capacity. It sets out the ways in which we hope to work collaboratively across the world and sets out the unique aspects of higher education in the UK and what it can bring to research and research collaborations. It's all kind of very much motherhood and apple pie stuff. A few years ago, we wouldn't have needed a strategy like this. And it is, although it's great to see the minister and the DfE getting behind the sector, it is a little sad that we do need to do something like this. So also this week, Chris has been speaking in the strangest debate in Parliament that I've ever seen in my life. The final statutory instrument that enacts the Higher Education and Research Act 2017. That was discussed on the floor of the House for reasons that I don't entirely understand. He had a scrutiny hearing with the Commons Education Select Committee, which was as interesting as these things always are. And just breaking as we put this podcast out, he's called on the sector to adopt the IHRA, that's the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, definition of anti-Semitism. This has seemed very much as the definition of anti-Semitism that should be widely accepted. It's the most complete, it's the most wide-ranging. You might recall a few months back, there was a massive controversy about the Labour Party adopting it, but adding their own little extra explanations about it. It's an interesting move from Chris. I think it is great that he is keen to see anti-Semitism tackled in the sector, and like all of us, he feels there is no place at all for any form of anti-Semitism or racism or any kind of other prejudice in the sector. I think we could all get behind that. But insisting on one particular definition, it does feel a little like it might start a couple of arguments in a few places. It remains to be seen, of course. I mean, obviously, this hasn't landed yet as we speak.
No, indeed, very much a live issue. Sarah, what's your take on Mr. Skidmore's interventions this week?
I think it's this, particularly on the anti-Semitism side, it's a really interesting debate, and one that, as DK was just mentioning, the concept that we all want to be fair and equitable and there to be no bias and judgment whatsoever is a theme that you'll hear a lot through this podcast, I'm sure. So I think making a stand to say that we should be adopting this definition is quite a powerful statement. But I think the point that DK made is really valid, that this will probably provoke quite a lot of question and more debate than it will successfully help answer at the moment.
Yeah, no, I think it's positive as well. I think it was disappointing that UK voted against adopting it, especially since NUS adopted it like 2 years ago, and it's usually more challenging to get things through NUS. But I think, you know, it comes within this broader tendency to sort of ignore the people most affected by these things. And I mean, the government yesterday rejected the APPG definition of Islamophobia put forward by Muslim groups, and it's going through Parliament today, I think. So, you know, with hate crime on the rise, I just think it's important that the leaders, both in the sector and outside it, start to listen, really.
I was just thinking it would be a good time to think about what people think of Chris Skidmore as a minister more generally. I mean, it's been getting on for 5.5-6 months since he was appointed. We've seen him in action in a few places and a few settings. I kind of feel like his style of interventions have been a lot more collegiate, a lot more consensual than his predecessors, and I feel like the contrast between him and Damien Hines is interesting. As we are at the Rules of Engagement event today, it would be interesting just to see how the sector are feeling about the current minister.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm David Bagshaw-Cope, Director of Strategic Change and Planning at Oxford Brookes University, and I've written a blog on why universities need to act as if we truly believe there's a climate and environment emergency. There are two reasons why I think we need to do this. First, the next generation expects us to take this issue really seriously. Greta Thunberg asks, why should I study when I have no future? Polls show that concern about climate change in the UK is at a record high, and that half of British consumers want companies to take a stand on issues that they care about. Second, collectively, we're large and we can make a difference. There are over 400,000 people employed in UK's universities with around 2.3 million students. Reducing the negative impact of our operations is necessary, but perhaps more importantly, we can make hugely positive changes through the contribution of our research, teaching and public engagement. So if you enjoy my blog on Wonky, please comment on it, tweet it and talk to your colleagues. Let's make something happen.
I'm Beth Button and I'm a campaign manager at University UK. I'm currently have the pleasure of delivering the Made at Uni campaign, which is aiming to bring to life the impact that UK universities have on people's everyday lives. And my blog this week is my reflections on what this campaign has taught me. It's taught me a little bit about how we should approach communicating to the public that I'm looking forward to sharing with you all. I think I've found that we should be using personal storytelling to show how we all benefit, not just those who attend university. We should find advocates for our messages. And importantly, I've concluded by finding that there's strength in unity, and I'm looking forward to your reading it.
Next up, as we are live from our event, Rules of Engagement, we talk about how the sector can better engage with politicians and the media. As part of the event, we commissioned some bespoke research by ComRes on what politicians think of universities. So, Luke, why don't you kick us off on this one?
Yes, so this is our insight into what MPs believe universities should prioritise. So there's some really interesting headlines. There's a bit of consensus around needing to respond to changing skills needs. So half of MPs think new courses in these areas should be a priority. But what those courses look like varies. So Labour MPs tend to prioritise representation and mental health provision, whereas Conservatives are more likely to prioritise institutions collaborating with industry and international outreach. The most interesting area that MPs want to hear about is widening participation and social mobility, although Labour MPs are more interested than Tories in hearing about that. And I think it's important stuff for anyone in the sector looking to lobby MPs. And Mark highlighted some of the pitfalls that VCs in particular fall down on last month.
No, indeed, Ian. I can highly recommend that blog. Of course, I would say that I'm biased, but on wonky.com, our editor-in-chief, Mark Lee, wrote a great blog a couple of weeks ago about the pitfalls that the sector often falls down when engaging with politicians. Sarah, what was your take on this?
Well, I found the comment from Mark Leach really, really quite funny in that he was describing some beautiful scenarios of how there was many opportunities for people to engage with politicians and wider, but how that all of those were basically not utilised to their full extent, I think it's polite to say. So I think my reflection on this is that I think politicians and the wider media need to understand a lot more about the sector. I'm only 2 years into the sector and have had an awful lot of learning, and every day still for me is something, an opportunity to learn more about what this incredible sector. I think there's also a bit of a tendency to think that we're all a bit special and a bit different, and that each institution is unique in its own right. But there's an awful lot of things that make us quite common in that. And I think we need to galvanise ourselves better to be able to present what some of those issues absolutely are. So I think for me, it's really interesting that this is an opportunity that we're missing a little bit, that we've all got different agendas and they're slightly different. So I definitely think this is a prime time to open up some debate about this.
I feel like the sector needs to think about what it wants to achieve by communicating, particularly with members of parliament and the messages that it is sending them. I mean, I'm fascinated in this comrades stuff, in the graphs that look at the differences between parties, that if you are talking about widening participation, widening access, you probably want to be talking to Labour MPs. If you want to be talking about collaborating with business and industry, you want to be talking to the Conservatives. It seems actually none of the parties are particularly likely to want to hear things about international outreach and expansion, which I think is really interesting, given that so much of the tenor of the communications of the sector have been about international recruitment, working internationally, global collaboration. It's not necessarily something that is top of MPs' priorities. So I think that, I mean, universities need to be careful about the message that they're putting across, especially now in the lead up to the Augur review. We can compare the way universities came across in the Brexit debates, which, let's be honest, I mean, universities came across terrible. They came across as shrill, as dogmatic, as completely focused on their own bottom line. It was not a good look for universities. And in the run-up to Augur, we're already starting to see a lot of the kind of HE against FE stuff that Chris Skidmore highlighted yesterday, and it just feels like we've not really learned the lessons of that campaign. Stuff around the civic university, the local role, I think is really, really important, and we have started making more noise on that, but it's still kind of very much an undercurrent to the general communications of the sector to Parliament, which are primarily about money or the lack of it.
And I think it would be interesting to know what our learners would actually want us to be conveying as well on their behalf, because that's a voice that we don't often hear much from.
It's true. I mean, the NUS lobbying operation is kind of very separate from the rest of the sector. Often we can be at cross purposes. I mean, Luke would probably know more about this than me.
Yeah, it's true. And I think the stuff around the civic university in particular is really helpful, because we need to have this united front in terms of advocating the public good that the HE brings, particularly with all of the Brexit stuff going on. And I think we really need some champions of HE in Westminster as well. And so the way we engage with politicians is so important. And you're right that the way NUS engages is distinct from other bodies, and there isn't that joined up approach, I think. I was reading recently actually about the Tory leadership contenders and how the more moderate ones might be thinking about promoting the role of universities, whereas obviously the hardliners are going to be more likely to attack. So there is scope here, I think, to be talking about this stuff, but I'm not sure we're doing it at the moment.
Right, let's see who else has been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name's Claire Alexander and I'm a Professor of Sociology at the University of Manchester. I've recently written a piece for the Wonky website, which is on our migration story, which is a teaching resource and website aimed at exploring diversity in the history curriculum and supporting teachers to teach more diverse histories in classes. The Migration Story website comes out of 10 years of research with partners at the University of Cambridge and the Runnymede Trust, which has been looking at how we teach histories in schools and how we develop a more inclusive curriculum, which focuses particularly on Britain as a country of migration. The implications for higher education, I think, are twofold, partly because across the university sector, there's been increasing concern around the lack of ethnic diversity, particularly in history, but also in politics, in geography and sociology, all of which disciplines are doing a lot of work on diversity, particularly ethnic and racial diversity, in their curriculum and in their staffing and in their student profiles. And secondly, it links to broader issues and campaigns around decolonising the curriculum. So our key argument in developing the website has been threefold. Firstly, that British history is a history of migration and has always been a history of migration and of change for the last 2,000 years. Secondly, that you can't understand modern Britain without this history, and that British culture, identity, language and so on are all completely unimaginable without this history of migration and the contribution of migrants from everywhere. And thirdly, that this needs to be reflected in how we think about our national identity and our national institutions. So we've worked with a number of museums, for example. And universities in particular, I think, are a key part of reflecting and pushing this change and bringing it to the kind of public consciousness.
Next up, we talk about a new book on social mobility. But before we get into that, I want to tell you about a new Wonky Plus subscription, giving you and your team even more essential HE policy insight and access to extra Wonky benefits. Along with the Wonky Daily delivered to your inbox at 8 a.m. every day, you'll get access to the termly Wonky Briefing, an horizon scan and a sense check about everything happening in HE policy. Ideal for those who can't follow every twist and daily turn. And as a Plus subscriber, you get exclusive free access to our monthly event, Wonky Live, so you can keep up to date with all the moving and shaking in HE policy in person with Team Wonky and experts from across the sector. You get free use of the Wonky Jobs Board, plus everyone from your organisation gets discounted rates on Wonky events and early access to tickets, including Wonkfest, which always sells out quickly. So for more information, contact us on briefing@wonky.com. That's briefing@wonky.com. Or you can visit the website wonky.com/plus. Next, a book is being published on the end of aspiration. The book highlights, even though we've had a huge expansion in the number of people entering higher education, recent generations are now more likely to have moved down the occupational hierarchy compared to where their parents were at the same age than they are to move up. Wonky's own Jim Dickinson was at the launch, so let's take a listen.
So I'm here with superhero Duncan Exley, author of The End of Aspiration. Duncan, give us a sense of what the book's about.
It's basically about the fact that the UK is presently experiencing net downward social mobility. We are now more likely to go down in the world than we are to go up in the world, and what's sitting behind that. And what really is behind that is that the people who did in a previous generation experience social mobility tended to have some stability in their lives when they were growing up. They tended to be able to mix socially and to meet posh friends who would broaden their horizons. They accessed opportunities that didn't cost something, and quite often now we have toll roads on the route to opportunity. And they accessed new opportunities that were coming up. That room at the top of new jobs being opened up, which isn't happening so much now.
One of the really compelling themes in the book is that lots of policy initiatives in different spaces, you know, either higher education or schools or in particular communities, don't join up properly. And I guess, you know, that part of that is a message for government. But, you know, lots of our readers work in particular slices of this policy problem. What would your message be to those people who are working perhaps in WP and universities or in student unions or in a particular space about the need for kind of joined up thinking?
Well, I think the most important thing is to work with people who have experienced this. I wrote in a previous piece for Wonky, ladders are best designed by people who've had to climb one. And that is always something there. And particularly to talk to people about what they have experienced before. Not only the sorts of schools they went to, the sorts of things they learned, but also their confidence issues and the sorts of things that they don't know. But also going the other way, that people leave higher education very often, and pretty much most of the people I interviewed experienced some feeling of drift because they didn't know where they were going afterwards. And we know that career services in higher education are patchy, and it's something that people from privileged backgrounds often don't need because their families can advise them. People from other backgrounds really do need to know what options are out there because no one has told them.
So Sarah, could you lead us off on this one, please?
Yeah, I think my first reflection on this is to say that this book is obviously going to be a very valuable contribution to what is a very complex debate. Everyone here listening and everyone on the podcast here are all passionate about the transformational properties of higher education. And that's obviously our focus. But as the recent Channel 4 documentary, for those of you who saw it, When I Grow Up, demonstrated, these aspirational perceptions from young people can often be very different from a very early age, which is really quite a sad reflection. Therefore, I think this is something that, HE aside, we need to really examine and address from early years education and upwards. So it isn't as simple as what we can do in HE, but obviously it starts a lot earlier. And I think my second reflection really is around the role that UCAS has to play here, which really does question us quite a lot. And I think we can look at that from both the learners and obviously the HE providers' perspective. From learners, one thing I absolutely adore about UCAS and the reason why I work here is that we treat everybody the same. It's one of the absolute benefits of having a centralised admission service. So we make the process transparent and the same for absolutely all learners, irrespective of their background. And we're actually trying to progress this in two different ways at the moment, one of which is through better information and advice. And we're really developing that at the moment, and hopefully a new portal for information advice will go live towards the autumn. And we're also developing our new application system, which will enable better self-declaration of information. So from a learner's perspective, it will ensure that they're being treated as a sort of an holistic individual rather than just another applicant. So I think that's, again, really, really strong from UCAS at the moment. But then when we look at the HE providers, I think UCAS actually have two roles in this, I suppose. One of which is to actively help providers make informed choices about applicants, which obviously can help them get into university in the first place. And we do that through the provision of contextual information. And we've all seen the debate recently on Wonky around MEM and POLA, and these are obviously something that are foundational for what UCAS provide. And I think the other role that we really have is to act as a bit of a mirror to the sector. So we publish over 2.5 million data points each cycle, which everyone I'm sure listening to this will be well versed on. So we help inform the debate. We also help providers to actually measure activities and actually sort of plot their trajectory and where they're trying to get to. So this is a really interesting debate, and it's obviously quite sad when we reflect upon the sort of key tenet of Duncan's book. But I think we are making some strides here for the better. But for all of this, it's all about sort of tiny marginal gains that we can be making, because we're almost the very end of a educational process, which we've got to address it from the start, really.
DK, I mean, talking of a million data points, you're a man who likes over a million data points. What was your kind of thoughts on this one?
I'm actually not going to talk about our data. I feel like this is a much wider issue about something that is happening in society in the UK more generally. There have been comments recently in the press about the fact that we're moving towards a more US model of inequality, where the vast majority of people have kind of very, very little, and a few people have absolutely loads. The idea that people are more likely to slide down, I think, plays into that conceptualization of the way society is heading. It was John Major, I think, who told us that we were all middle class now, and I would hesitate to say that that is necessarily true. Obviously I've not read the book yet because it's only just out, but I have bought it and I'm looking forward to reading it. I'd like what it was saying about aspirations, the idea that you need a solid base, you need to feel secure and safe and nurtured and cared for in order to aspire beyond that. It's kind of a basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs stuff. If you've not got the hygiene factors in place, it's quite difficult to progress into self-actualization. And I love the idea of the posh friend. I don't know if anybody else picked that up. I mean, I had a posh friend, and it is debatable actually whether I would have seriously considered university if it wasn't for my posh friend. And just the idea that we could, as a society, we seem to be less capable of social mixing. The divide between the well-off and the not-so-well-off seem to be growing and growing. We go to different places, we eat different foods, we watch different media, we listen to different people. And it really does kind of worry me that it is possible higher education will be seen as a good for the kind of people who shop at Waitrose. And it is so much more than that. It has such a lot more to offer.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what you say is important. We're a decade on from The Spirit Level, that book about equality being published. And they talked about how more unequal societies have worse, you know, health, mental health, education, imprisonment, all kinds of areas of society. And it does seem worrying that we're not getting better. Just thinking about the sector in particular, last time I was on the podcast, we had the UCAS data and we were talking about admissions. I think it is interesting that Duncan Exley, the author, talks about admissions as well, and talks about how HE needs to get better at recognizing prior experience. And I think it is worth thinking about, you know, more contextualized offers and admissions procedures as well.
I mean, absolutely. It's all about applicants' potential rather than just their attainment when they go into university. And it's, like I said, it's about treating individuals as an individual rather than just, you know, what their predicted grades look like.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question live is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Hi, we're just about to move into talking about league tables, so this is a very special Yes, But Does It Correlate today, featuring the ever-controversial world of the rankers. I've plotted this year's institutional ranking in the Complete University Guide against the ranking in the Times Good University Guide. The first three places were the same in each this year, but what about the rest? How similar a result do the different methodologies give? Yes, but does it correlate?
I think the way that your mind works, DK, I'm being counterintuitive, I think it will not correlate, because one would assume there had to be some kind of loose correlation between how these things are graded and such. But I think after the first three, there is not a correlation.
So I think they both have a lot of similar metrics. I don't know about the weighting, but I know they both look at NSS and REF and like spending on facilities and stuff. So I'm going to say yes.
Oh, I think I might agree with Luke, because I think some of the, while the constituent parts might be flawed in their own way, they're all equally as flawed. So I suspect it might be correlating.
That is a lovely position. And yes, there is a correlation. R squared is 0.86, which is a strong correlation, but not a staggeringly strong correlation, which surprised me. Clearly, the two tables are using slightly different methodologies. For example, the Times looks at teaching quality and the student experience as two separate NSS-derived measures. But the CUG looks at student satisfaction as the sole measure it takes from NSS. But the CUG examines research quality and research intensity. The Times looks at just research quality. So they tell broadly the same story, which makes me think, as you say, that the rankings are using the same or similar data. But it is different enough, especially in the middle part of the table, to make me think that there is something else interesting going on. As usual, the graph is on the podcast page on the Wonky website for you to play with if you'd like. And for the completists, I've taken the 2019 ranking for the Times and the 2020 for CUG, which are the most recent available, and I've only plotted institutions where they feature in both tables.
And finally this week, the only league table that counts was published. Yes, the 2019 ranking of universities based on availability of car parking spaces is now live on wonky.com. So DK, as the architect of this prestigious ranking, could you walk us through this one, please?
So an astonishing number of people appear to have taken this ranking seriously. So I just want to say up front at the top, this is not a serious way of ranking universities. I'm not saying a university with an easier parking experience by these metrics are any better. I'm not saying that the metrics are any good because they're from the HESA estate record, which, as we all know, is for entertainment purposes only.
And that's where I get my kicks, the HESA estate record. That's on my, every Saturday night.
Friday
that's
night,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, what a treat.
Well, you're going to really enjoy Yes, But Does It Correlate for the next few weeks. That's all I'm going to say. So what I'm trying to do here is to highlight, first of all, the ridiculousness of the rankings industry and the strange way in which people in HE respond to rankings. I also took a little shot at the University of the Year idea because, I mean, Rittle University College is the proud possessor of the title of the Wonky Car Parking University of the Year 2020. I actually did ring their press office and tell them. I don't think they were that impressed. But I mean, just looking more generally, you can take any combination of metrics. You can make them into something broadly meaningful. I mean, the underlying metric of car parking ease is just the demand for car parking against the supply of car parking. But I still also think that car parking is an integral part of the student and staff experience of higher education. I know I've been to meetings and not actually attended the meetings because I've been unable to find a place to park my car.
Yeah, and I echo that. Yeah, someone who travels the length and breadth of the country visiting universities, it can be an incredible challenge. Which permit you've got, which particular space you've got, you're parked 17 buildings away from the meeting and things like that.
And, you know, actually, as a SU officer at a small town uni, I'm going to come out in defence of the 2019 wonky car parking rankings because, I mean, most of my complaints from students are nothing to do with their course or facility. It's just about the car parking and the availability. So, you know, this is the future.
It's critical. But Sarah, I'd be interested in your take more broadly on rankings because you have quite an interesting position in the sector in that, you know, you're the people who are helping people access universities and be recruited into universities. So I wonder what your kind of general thoughts on kind of the use of league tables and how applicants use them and whether that's, you know, a good or bad thing, whether they're good at signposting certain stuff.
I think they certainly are. What we've seen through our research is that different groups of applicants use league tables in that generic sense in different ways. So when you're looking at, for instance, international students, that comes up really high in their list of priorities. When you're looking across the board to all applicants, the most important thing that they go on when they're making their choices is around the content of their modules and what they're actually be studying, which I suppose is quite reassuring for all of us in the HE sector. But interestingly, the second thing that comes out as being the most important is actually student reviews. So like I say, different groups of students look at different things and weight them in terms of importance. But number one was what they're studying, and number two is what other people, their peers, are saying about university. So I'm really a passionate advocate for the fact that we need to listen to what the students are saying and engage with students in that sort of dialogue because it's incredibly important. But league tables obviously play their part.
Luke, I mean, you represent what, tens of thousands, forgive me, Edge Hill, I don't know how big it is, but I imagine you can speak authoritatively for all of them. But in terms of kind of how they kind of interact with their university, do they care about where they're ranked? I mean, do you care? Is it, I mean, of course you're going to care about your car parking ranking now, I imagine.
Yeah, so it's 15,000. And well, I think that we're very proud. Our institution is very proud of having like TEF, for instance. And I'm not sure that our students on the ground are that interested. We do celebrate when there are positives, particularly on rankings that are more powered by student voice. So things like What Uni, which are like driven by student submissions. But I think one of the more broad issues is that a lot of the rankings aren't built on things that students think are valuable. So if you look at like teaching quality rankings, for instance, they're not looking at the areas that we know from surveys and polling students value the most. So maybe if we did, then they might.
Yeah. I mean, all of this, I mean, it is, if you'd permit me a little diversion. It reminds me of Jean Baudrillard's idea of the empty signifier. It's the fact that, I mean, you are 7th or 16th or in the top 50 or whatever else, and that is much more important than what the ranking actually means, what actually underlies it. It's a status symbol.
We see that definitely in our research on TEF, because obviously TEF is a really positive thing for the sector. But when you speak to learners, they actually haven't really understood exactly what TEF is measuring and why you might be interested in it. However, a lot of them look at it and go, oh, well, that's gold, so that must be better than that one. So they, exactly as you're saying, it's a sort of, you know, gold is best, therefore that's what I'm going to be applying to.
It's condensing a very, very complex data-driven value judgment into a very, very simple one. And it's actually baking in a lot of prejudice. There's a lot of deceived ideas. And that kind of concerns me slightly. I mean, the research I like best on this, it was done in 2013 by Hefke, and they looked at the way students use the information that's out there about universities when they make their application choices. And for the most part, they don't. They don't use the information at all. As you say, they talk to their family, their friends. And I really like that idea that a key part of a decision is something like the open day, the prospectus, the chance to actually see the place and experience the place. It becomes a much more human a choice than a much less algorithmic choice.
So that is about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find the links in the show notes. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Sarah, to Luke and to DK and to everyone at Team Wonky for making this happen. And until next week, stay ranking.